to have us reconvene. Thank you very much. Our first action item, I would like to turn to Regent Barnes for a reading of a resolution and some comments for Regent Alex Trujillo. This is his last meeting in this official capacity, so we'll turn the time to Regent Barnes.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and honor for me to get to read or share with you this resolution of appreciation. I'm not going to spend time reading through it. You have it in front of you. It's obvious he is remarkable in all areas of his life, but I'll just say a word or two personally about Alex and our association. I think we feel across the Board of Regents, anyone who's had the opportunity to work with him and know what a remarkable young man he is, who has overcome amazing barriers and obstacles and been a champion this last year in his service as a regent. On the completion committee, he's the one who initiated the student tours, which has been one of the most meaningful experiences I've had on my service as a regent, and getting connected with the students and the way he led that and led the initiative of student success and student focus, which I think we're all continuing to learn the importance of that, and that's what it's all about. But I just wish you the best and want to make the resolution now, therefore, be it resolved that the Utah State Board of Regents, joined by the Commissioner of Higher Ed and his entire staff and institutional presidents, faculty, staff, and students who have worked with Alex, hereby extend sincere expression of appreciation and respect and wish him the very best in his future endeavors.
Great, thank you. Do we have a motion? Do I have a second? Okay, thank you very much, Regent Gibson. So, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And Alex, we have the actual original of the resolution. Can we have you go ahead and open that, Alex, and Bob, Regent Markwart?
Should I open it like it's Christmas?
Yes, with enthusiasm. <Yeah. laughs> We hope you'll remember your time with us fondly, and it's indicated you've been a strong contributor, and you've been very, very good about being in attendance, not just at our region meetings, but at other activities, and really have left your fingerprints on a lot of what we do. So thank you. And turn the time for Regent Markwart for.
Okay. Before we get into the election of a new chair and vice chair, I just wanted to recognize Dan and thank him for what he's done as chair. He's not actually leaving the Board of Regents, so he doesn't get a resolution today. But in my time on the Board of Regents, his leadership is second to none. I mean, he's really put his heart and soul into this whole operation, and he's created more focus for the Board of Regents than we've had in the past, kind of reorganized our meetings, or, you know, questions over the years of, you know, are we sitting here just approving things and not getting into substantive discussions. So he's rearranged our days and thrown out the committee meetings and put the whole thing upside down, but in a very positive way and very strategic in the direction that he's pushed the Board of Regents. I don't think anybody's done more for outreach and advocacy for higher education than Dan has done. He's spent endless hours at the legislature, more than any chair I've seen, and almost rivaling what Dave is going up there, but he's reaching out to the business community and we've created a much stronger alliance with the boards of trustees than we've had before. So we're really operating as one team and got a very good relationship with the presidents of the institutions and friendship with the governor that doesn't help anything. It doesn't hurt anything, I meant to say. Excuse me. I did not mean that. I think it's not right. Well,
thanks, Bob.
I think maybe it's worked both ways at actually. So that, you know, he has stood up very strong to the governor on certain issues as well as the legislature, and he's dealt with a number of difficult issues, and since I've already got myself in trouble, I won't go into the detail of the difficult issues, but you know where they are. But and a good friend of all of us, so I really want to thank Dan for all of the time and effort he's put in. He even ran for re-election, so he didn't volunteer to do that again, though, but I really appreciate what you've done. You're a good friend, and thank you, Dan.
Well, thank you very much. After all those nice things, I actually thought Bob was a pretty good guy, and I don't,
obviously lacking in judgment. But
this has been a great experience.
You'd think if we graduate, we'd be able to open a box, don't you think, Alex?
This may be why you're opening.
Oh,
that.
This is great.
There you go.
We were just talking about these gavels. I was saying these are great. I'm gonna have to get one for Sunday dinners, you know. But now I have one. This is very nice.
Nice.
Thank you very much. You know, this is a little bit like reading your own death notice. You know? But I would like to actually have Alex maybe take just one moment to introduce, even though she won't be sworn in until our next meeting, but if you could introduce Jaquel so we just get to know her.
Yeah. So it is my pleasure to recognize Jaquel Larson, the newly appointed student regent, and we'll have her stand up if she will. She's in here in the audience. She's shadowing today. Jaquel Larson is one of the most vibrant and just outgoing personalities that I know. She's also the most kind person that I know. She and I have had just a really fun time at UVU while we were students together. We were presidential interns for President Holland's presidential cabinet, and that was one of the most cool experiences that I've had with her. She's been very, very involved, and right now she's an MPA student at the University of Utah, already doing incredible things. She's just a fireball, and I've said that before. So let's have a round of applause in congratulating her for appointing for this position.
Thank you very much, Jaquel, and we look forward to working with you. I have to say, she was visiting with Alex a little bit at the beginning of lunch, and I just wanted to point out to her that Alex has been a great example of a student regent and having a full voice and using that voice. And I know that Jaquel will do the same. It was interesting. I can't remember what function it was at, but the selection of a new president at UVU. I can't remember, but I was walking down the hallway to head to the garage to go home, and I hear somebody call my name, and there's Jaquel. She just wanted to make sure that I, you know, had a chance to meet her, and, you know, she was at that point in the process where she was down to, like, three finalists, but just, you know, very friendly and open, and I know that we'll enjoy her contributions this next year. So with that, I would like to then move to our next item of business, which is a report from the nomination committee and election of a chair and vice chair. So I would like to turn the time to Regent Jensen, who was the chair of this committee, who also consisted of Christina Ortega and Steve Lund. So
I'm right here.
Oh, there you are. I'm getting older. I don't turn quite as well.
Thank you, Chair Campbell. I'm grateful that we were able to praise Caesar before we bury him here.
I'm done.
So, as you mentioned, it was my honor to chair a nominating committee along with two fellow lawyers, Regent Lund and Regent Ortega. If you want to take a small and simple task and give it to three lawyers, they're going to do something grand with it. And we did. And I thought maybe just to educate us all a little bit about the law that surrounds this process, I would just share with you a section from the Utah Code, which gives us our authority as regents to do what we're doing today. It says that the board shall elect a chair and a vice chair from among the board's members who shall serve terms of 2 years and until their successors are chosen and qualified. And then we've given a little more meat to that bone in our bylaws, R120, which says that the Board of Regents shall elect a chair at its May or June meeting in even-numbered years, which is where we are today. Chair serves 2 years, beginning on the date of his election, and a chair may not serve more than two terms, which you've done, Dan. And then the vice chair is elected in the same meeting, May and June of each even-numbered year, serves a two-year term concurrently with the chair. And the way I read our bylaw, there's only one term for the vice chair. And that's something that Harris has completed. So that's our legal framework. Our approach was to try to be as neutral. None of the three of us had any leadership or political ambitions. That's partly what qualified us for service on the nominating committee. And we divided the group of us up into three groups, and each of us called four or five of you, and began by indicating that Harris Simmons, who's absent today, traveling abroad, had been nominated for chair to succeed Mr. Campbell here, and we ask you all to express yourselves about that nomination. I might just pause there by saying that universally, unanimously, everyone felt very good about Harris's service as our vice chair and about the prospects of having him as our leader for the next 2 years. His term actually will expire in 2021, but he's in his first term, so he could be reappointed as a regent and would then have the legal opportunity, if he chose, to run again 2 years from now. But at this point, with our polling indicating unanimous support for him, I would like to place in his name in nomination for our new chair of the Board of Regents to succeed Chair Campbell, and give that to you to act on at this time. Dan?
Thank you very much, Regent Zinnison. We have a motion. Do I have a second? Second from Regent Thomas. Right, and so any questions or discussion before we call for a vote? Being none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Okay. Harris will be delighted, thrilled. He's talking to groups of shareholders in the international area. He didn't absent himself on purpose today, though it might have been wise. But he's looking forward very much to being our chair and carrying on with the exceptional leadership that we've had, Dan, under you. So in the matter of the vice chair, in addition to talking about Harris Simmons to each of you, we asked each of you if you had any desire to be nominated for either chair or vice chair. And you were all characteristically very modest. We asked you then if there was someone you wanted to put into nomination for the vice chair's position. And there were several nominated. By far, the majority of nominations were in favor of Nina Barnes. And so wanting this process to be democratic, not a negotiated convention, we then went back after conferring with each other and with our leadership and approached each of you individually who had either been nominated or had expressed a desire to perhaps be nominated, and indicating at the same time that there was a clear majority preference already in place for Nina Barnes. And at that point, based either on a desire to wait until some future time to become more knowledgeable maybe about our processes in the case of some of you who are relatively new, or because of time constraints, or in a case or two, just people again who weren't interested, even though others hoped they might be, we were able to, in a sense, come to a finding that, again, in the case of Nina, we could put her name before us today, nominated to be our vice chair. Nina's term also expires in 2021, and she fulfilled an unexpired term when she began of about 3 years. She and I actually came aboard at the same time. So in 2021, she and I will bid you adieu. Lorreen, you might start looking now for something appropriate. And so this would be just a 2-year term for her with no opportunity to run for higher office. I thought in the interest of full disclosure and your complete knowledge of all of this, you should know these facts. But with that said, Nina, you enjoy the same kind of respect and admiration and unanimous support that Harris did, and so I'm honored to nominate you to become the vice chair of the Board of Regents for the next 2 years.
Great. Thank you very much, Regent Jensen. We have a nomination, a motion. Do we have a second from Alex Trujillo, Regent Trujillo? Any discussion? Being none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Welcome.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I am sorry that Harris is not able to be with us today, but duty calls him elsewhere. But I know that he'll be a great chair, and I know that Nina will give her all and be a great vice chair. But I'd like to turn, in Harris's absence, turn some time to Nina for you to be able to share some thoughts.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the opportunity, and I so appreciate the confidence and friendship I enjoy amongst all of you. Unfortunately, I wish Harris was here and could say a few words, but I'm sure my sentiments will cover his as well. But just what a privilege it is to be amongst you and work in this system of higher ed, from staff to faculty to presidents to folks on your campuses. It's just been one of the highlights of my life. And on top of that, to be able to work with higher education and in an area that we all feel so passionate about is just been the greatest. And to feel, especially coming off of this morning's discussion, and the difference we are able to help others make in their lives is really, really fulfilling and really important work. And so I hope as we move forward that I'll be able to represent all of you very well. And moving us forward and working with the commissioner's office and continue on the trajectory that we've been on of great success and completion attainment for our students in Utah. We'll have a better citizenry. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. Anyhow, excited to work with the commissioner. Appreciate everything that the chair and vice chair have done for us, and just looking forward to it. So thank you.
Just ask Commissioner, and you know, with the new leadership team, that maybe there's some opportunity to evaluate our policies with regard to a nomination and terms. It does seem a little bit odd to me that we have our leadership terms expire on even years, and yet most of us have terms as individual regents which expire on an odd year, which kind of prevent someone from being able to line up their term of service with the, and so, you know, for example, Harris, he's going to have one additional year after his 2-year term, and for, you know, vice chairs as well. Just be nice perhaps to look at matching those up so someone isn't left with a hanging year, so.
Yeah.
You're funny. Okay. I'm glad that on this, on our notices, it talks about the board chair retains the right to take action at any time, because I did go out of order a little bit. So I would now, with everyone being present and having had the opportunity to kind of reflect on their lunch, I do want to allow us to take a few minutes as regents or presidents or whoever to
share any comments you may have based upon your discussions at lunch with Salt Lake Community College students, anything that you learned that you think would be of benefit to us. Any comments?
I had two remarkable young women at my table, and as I was visiting with them, I just thought, isn't it comforting to those of us that are moving on in life that we have such vibrant, outstanding, and committed, and diverse young people coming to and excited to get involved and to take over leadership. And I just left lunch feeling just like it can't get any better than this. So I congratulate you, Denise, on your selection of students. The two at my table were outstanding, and I just think it makes us all, it's our, kind of like our payday. This is the kind of students that our system's turning out, and we can all be proud for that and very hopeful for the great things that they'll accomplish.
Other comments? Yes.
Similar, you know, experience, a wonderful young man and a young woman at our table. And the young man, I was just impressed. He's the first generation college student, and indicated that his parents couldn't afford for him to go to college, but have always encouraged him. And because of the scholarship programs, President, that you have here, he's here on scholarship. And I found it interesting, his motivation, he's working two jobs in addition to going to school so that he can go on to, I will mention, Utah State. just happened to be that.
But, that wasn't where he was at the beginning of the lines, but that's where he is.
Working two jobs to be able to afford to go. And I sat there thinking, I don't know, I hope I would have had that same kind of passion and motivation if I hadn't had more of a support system, and to see students who do that with all the reasons in the world not to, that says it all, I think. And very impressive, both students. So.
Good. Yes.
This was one of the best lunches ever. Thank you, Denise. I met with Sochi and Priscilla, and one thing that really stuck out with me, among talking about their stories, how they got to your college, they are determined to give back. They're both involved in your first year experience, giving back to the students. And I think that's really at the core of everything. They are determined to really be a guide and a light to those students who are following in their footsteps. And I really appreciate the fact, I know there were questions for us to ask of them, but we didn't even have to go there because they were doing Barbara Walters with us and turned the tables and asked us a lot of questions, which I really appreciated. But I really do appreciate the fact that they are dedicated to really connecting with those that follow behind them.
Good. Okay. Yes, Regent Lennon and then Regent Jensen.
I had kind of a fun system observation. I was sitting at the same table as Ron, but talking to the young woman next to me who's just finished her first year and wants to be a computer scientist. She mentioned that all of her siblings, she's the youngest of four, I think, who have come through Salt Lake Community College. She's got older, she plans to leave next year and go up to Weber State. She's got a sister or a brother at Utah State, another one at the University of Utah, and another one down at UVU. And so they're just making they're covering all the check marks. But so Salt Lake Community College ends up being a feeder for all of our institutions, or virtually all of our institutions, as it turns out, as played out in this genealogy that we were seeing here today.
This would speak to something, a loose end maybe, that could be financially significant. We asked the three that we were sitting with, who were also exceptional, about their use of the Open Educational Resources Program, Denise, that you have been such a champion of, and they all expressed admiration and personal benefit from it. But they did say, too, that there are a number of classes yet where a person is required to purchase the textbook, and that among the students in their subculture, the operative word is don't buy the textbook until the professor makes you use it, which often he does not. So that might be something we could look into, because that can be a significant expenditure semester by semester if they're required to buy it and it's not in use.
We're doing a lot of study right now on our Open Education Resources program, and we're trying to strengthen it and widen it. We'll have over 1,000 sections this fall.
Wow.
That operate with an open education resource, meaning there's no textbook. And one of the things that we're doing now that's, I think, going to be very helpful is in our student information system, when they register, they can now search their course options by low or no cost textbook. So they can put in that attribute and say, I only want to see courses in English or math or biology that use an OER option or have a low textbook cost, which is under $40. So they can kind of finance their, they can in their own mind understand the cost of what that those books are going to cost them or those open OER is going to cost them. So there is some work to be done on faculty that don't use a required text, but we're trying to strengthen that across.
I just wanted to compliment President Hufteland from what I heard at my table. I was at the table with a couple of remarkable people too. One of them, Marcos, had been in a situation where he wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do for 4 years after he barely graduated, as he said, from high school. And it was really the embracing that he felt here that not only, you know, brought him here, but kept him here. And he had, he calls you Denise, by the way, which I think is a compliment. And just the importance of even one comment by an instructor saying, you're really good at this, turned his pathway forward. And it typically is that, but he really felt like this was his home and his community, and I need to congratulate you for that, for setting a culture of that. I think all of our institutions do that, but it was great to hear that.
Good. Let me just add, I had a nice discussion along with Mark and others with two students, Jay from South Korea and Ayuna from Japan. Interesting that both of them were told about Salt Lake Community College in this area by family members or others, acquaintances who felt that the school was safe and a good place, very welcoming, and they felt that. They felt like they were given the help, the counseling, the orientation that they needed to feel comfortable in swimming in these waters. And they, when first asked if there was anything that they felt like we could do better, they said no, but I just want to indicate that a couple minutes later, they both indicated that, well, one thing might be is if the library could be open on Friday and Saturday evening past 5 o'clock. Okay. Because they are clearly dedicated students. That you would not have received that request from me, but they, but they, on Friday and Saturday evenings, they have friends from Salt Lake Community College that actually go up to the University of Utah to the library there to be able to continue their studies. So that was the only point. And I had the opportunity to visit with probably six or seven others who were at different tables, and they were very well prepared, very open in sharing their experiences. And one had written questions for, you know, for me, and it was a great experience. So well done, and it was, I think, it was a great experience for all of us as regents. And just by not, is this something that you think you'd like to continue, or at least on a rotating basis, to be able to continue that association? Good. I think that's great.
Chair Campbell, if I can just thank many of our staff. This was a fairly recent request that we got, and it's not a real busy time right now on our campus, so we were a little concerned about finding that many students. So I just have to give credit to our staff in student life and leadership and student affairs, and to try to get a real cross section of students. You know, this is really easy to kind of prime the pump and just roll out the, you know, generate like the graduates of excellence, but we really tried to give you a cross section of students that are involved or not involved, working, not working. And I give credit to the staff who really rose to that. And I want to just say too that the culture and the welcoming and the faculty kinds of things you heard, that I get to sit here and hear those compliments and have them directed at me, but we have 4,000 plus employees who make that happen, and I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge our faculty and staff.
Good. Maybe if we can just give a hand of appreciation to Salt Lake Community College and President Huftalin and all the staff for preparing this beautiful room with the banners and welcoming signs and great lunch and everything. Appreciate all that you've done to make us feel welcome. Thank you so much. Well, I have to say that Bob caught me off guard a little bit today. I had not anticipated receiving a gavel. I was really kind of shocked. But I do want to just express my appreciation for the opportunity I've had to serve as chair of this body. It's been a great privilege to be able to work with our presidents and our commissioner's office, all of them, the staff, and especially you as regents. I can't think of another board or body that I serve on that feels so united in its objectives. I mean, we are involved in a good work, and it's a pleasure to be engaged in that process with others who are spending their time and taking away from their livelihood or other interests that they have to make sure that we're providing the best system of higher education that we can. It's not perfect. We have much work to do, but we have made some improvement. I think about when I was first talked to about being whether I would be willing to serve in leadership and thinking about things like trustee engagement and selection, presidential selection, or an R&Rs, or, you know, an issue for me at the time was acute equity and things. You know, to be a citizen and yet to be able to be engaged in things that can make a difference is important. And so the time we render is of real value, and I appreciate the opportunity to work with you. But the successes we've had and that we will have are not because of leadership. They may play some role, but it's really because of each of you as regents and presidents and commissioner's office people. I mean, it's you think about where those ideas come from and the committees that you serve on. Those are where the rubber is really hitting the road. And so I just hope that each of us as regents can continue to be engaged and push forward those things we at our strategic retreat, you know, the ideas that we had, and those of you who are on committees and leading out on some of these areas, it makes a difference. I mean, if we're not fully engaged, then we're not going to go anywhere. So I appreciate the fact that you have been and will be engaged. And so I it was interesting with the selection of the UVU president. I had a number of comments. Some of them have, you know, obviously been very complimentary of all the process that we've had in selecting new presidents. I've been around long enough to know each of our presidents as we've selected and rotated through a few as well. But, you know, the fact that we now have a system that has four women presidents is really telling. And you know, I had someone ask me a question kind of like, you know, why are you selecting women, you know, four? And, you know, you've had like your last, you know, four out of six or whatever women. Well, because they've been the best candidates. It's and I know that you go about your work seriously, and we have great presidents who are fully engaged and great, you know, provosts and deans and professors that also love this work and are committed. So thank you very much for the association I've had of working with each of you, and I wish you well, and I'm just glad that I have one more year to lean in a little bit. So thank you. Next item of business I'd like to bring forward is our general consent calendar in tab A. I hope each of you have had the opportunity to review that. If there are any questions or comments with regard to the general consent calendar, if not, could I call for a motion to approve? Okay, Regent Jones, motion to approve, and second from Regent Thomas. Right, so, okay, all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, motion carries. I'd like to turn now to the adoption of policy R211, President Emeritus Designation, and I'll turn to Commissioner Buehler for that.
Thank you, Chair Campbell, and at the risk of making this entirely a testimonial today, I just need to thank Chair Campbell for being a wonderful chair. I agree with all of the good things that have been said, and it's been my opportunity while working in the commissioner's office, not as commissioner, but to work with five chairs. And Dan has been either vice chair or chair during the 6 years so far that I've been commissioner, and super engaged, super helpful, always told me what I needed to hear, and if whether I wanted to or not sometimes, but just very supportive also, and so thank you, Dan. Okay, I'm bringing forward to you a new policy, R211. This is to provide a system approach to, on occasion, when appropriate, to be able to designate a retiring president as president emeritus. This is an honorary honorary designation. It does not include compensation or other benefits or anything like that of a financial nature, but to recognize those who have led in our system, who have served in significant leadership, and who are either retiring, leaving administration, leaving higher ed leadership, or returning to the faculty. And so you have that before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any. So it'd be the new R211.
Any questions, comments? Okay, being none, do we have a motion to approve R211?
I'd like to make it. Under the provisions of policy,
We need to adopt this first. We'll have Regent Anderson make that as a motion. Do I have a second?
Second
from Regent Barnes. Thank you very much. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? No, I'm sorry. Regent Anderson, please proceed.
So under the provisions of policy R211, I move that the Board of Regents grant Dr. David W. Pershing the designation of President Emeritus of the University of Utah.
Great, thank you. We have a motion. Do I have a second? From Regent Ortega. Any further discussion? Being none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. It's kind of nice to ratify kind of what we've done. All right. Thank you very much, Regent Anderson. I'd like to turn now to our 2018 strategic initiative.
I'll be doing that.
Pardon?
I'll be doing that.
Oh, yeah, okay. Strategic initiatives, and we'll turn to Commissioner Buehler for that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, that's something we've been working on for some time, and this is to kind of bring back to the board the work that we've done earlier this year with the working groups as well as in our study session in April. And just to remind you that the overall goal of our strategic plan, which was adopted by you a few years ago, is to increase the educational attainment of Utahns to enhance both quality of life and to meet Utah's current and future workforce needs. Some time ago, you set as strategic priorities affordable participation, timely completion, and research and workforce. We are now adding a fourth one, which has always been a priority, but to make sure that it's that we are recognizing it as we should, capacity and growth. Now, as you all know, and just for any public who are in attendance or listening and who might not be as familiar, in November, Chair Campbell established Regent Working Groups to work on these issues. And between in the January and March meeting, we had an opportunity to hear updates from the working groups to the board. And then at our study session, the work groups presented some priority initiatives. Let's see, did I go too fast? Okay. And so of those, from the working groups, we had really six strategies or initiatives that were identified, and I'm going to take some time to go through these in a moment. Addition to that, and this was kind of on a separate track, but another strong priority that we develop a strategic communications plan. There's been a group of regents appointed to assist our office with that, and also previously we had a working group on student mental health recommendations, which, as you noted with President Huftalen's presentation, and we've asked each president when the regents meet on their campus to provide us an update of their efforts in implementing those recommendations which you've already adopted. But what I'm bringing forward to you, we had a lot of discussion about how much can we take on, how quickly can we go, and so forth. And as I met as a staff after our April session, met with our staff, we just concluded, while we appreciate you being willing to prioritize, these are also important. We need to be working on them all as we're able to. But we put them in kind of a tier as far as what we will start with immediately and what will take longer, and we will start with them or that they're ongoing. And so automatic acceptance notification, this really ties into the discussion we had earlier this morning as far as helping high school graduates and their parents know what the options are then for the college, what the open access options are, how do they enroll, how do they obtain financial aid, as well as for those students that are prepared for the more selective institutions, what those options are. And so this is something that we will be starting on. It will take some time, but we've got a lot of details to work out. Also, statewide data strategy with data analytics that the institutions are doing, stackable bachelor's degrees to tie in from CTE or certificates up through associate and bachelor's degrees to meet workforce needs. Other priorities are student aid and tuition. We're going to talk about an aspect of that later this afternoon. Of course, continuing on the mental health recommendations and improving information to students on workforce options, as well as our outreach office is reaching out to schools with step-up schools to try to target those populations that maybe otherwise wouldn't know that they have an opportunity to go to school, as well as developing our strategic communications plan. So as I mentioned, we're going to start with these three, and then we'll be moving on to these others. In each of these areas, we'll be developing specific metrics and timelines and work plans, and so you're going to be seeing this go forward. I don't want to mislead you in any way that this is just something that's going to magically happen. It's going to take lots of work, lots of collaboration with our institutions, but we really think that the working groups have come forward with some ideas that can really move the ball forward in several important areas to implement your strategic priorities. And we also plan to, by using this, then update the strategic plan. We'll have that for you probably in the November meeting to kind of reconstitute the strategic plan of the Board of Regents and the system of higher education. Also, just to make you aware, next year will be the 50th anniversary of the Board of Regents. That bill was sponsored in 1969 by Senator Dixie Levitt, Cedar City. And we're going to look at opportunities that we can maybe tie into that as we talk about our priorities, as we develop a communications plan. And as one of the suggestions, which I thought was so great, is we need to not just reflect on the last 50 years, but talk about what are we doing in the next decade, the next maybe even 50 years, or how are we moving forward as a state and for higher education in the future. But just to use that opportunity for communications. So, Mr. Chair, that completes my report, but I would be happy to answer any questions, and there is an action item on this as well.
Commissioner, would you mind going back a couple slides? Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, the one that kind of highlighted the ones that you're working on versus the maybe back one more.
Yeah.
Because I do think it's important that the pull that we have is that we have so many things we would like to really be engaged on, and yet we know that we have limited resources in the commissioner's office and at our individual institutions that might support here. But I do wonder, our strategic communications plan, while we have it listed under affordable participation, you know, we do have a committee that's been appointed. Right. Our discussion this morning about maybe focusing on community college or the benefits of higher education we've talked about in the past, or, you know, I'm just wondering if that could be on kind of a parallel path.
Yes.
Because I do worry that if we focus on these other items, that further deferring that communications plan is going to hurt us. And it seems like with 2019 being a 50th year, it'd be a good year to have a great communications plan of what we've done and where we're going. And so maybe
yes.
If I could just say that maybe that's...
Thank you for letting me clarify that. This was only... That is already on a parallel track.
Okay.
So this is just that from the working groups, these are the three that we're starting with, where strategic communications, that's moving forward, just like the mental health recommendations are moving forward. So I think I didn't state that exactly right. So thank you for letting me clarify that.
Questions, comments on the commissioner's report? Okay. All right. So then in terms of the approval of our 2018 strategic initiatives, do I have a motion to approve? So moved by Regent Jensen. Do I have a second? Regent Lund, thank you very much. Any further discussion, questions? Being none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. I'd like to turn the time now to Regent Marlon Jensen as Vice Chair of the Academic and Student Affairs Committee to address the revision of Policy 312.
Since the Commissioner's recommendation on this is so, since the recommendation written here by the Commissioner's office is so succinct, I'll just read it. During the 2017 legislative session, the legislature passed SB 238, which provided specific statutory language regarding the respective institutions' roles and missions. The revision of Regent Policy R312 incorporates the specific language of SB 238 and aligns language of the policy with the intent of the statute change. Regent's Policy R312 establishes the roles and missions of USHE institutions. The legislature provided added specificity to those roles, identifying the following specific roles: research universities, regional universities, and comprehensive community colleges, to align with the new statutory language. Major changes to the policy include added clarity on the meaning of open admissions and the expectations for admission practices at regional universities, clear expectations for new master's degree program sustainability measures, recognition of the dual missions of regional universities. Regarding open admissions, the policy allows for the board to consider exceptions to strict open admissions, which is something that Dr. Cook made reference to this morning in our discussion, such as Southern Utah University's current practice of open admissions for its service area and selective admissions for those outside the service area. These revisions will ensure the board complies with the governing law and will better reflect the institutional roles and missions. If you've examined the redlined copy of the revised rule, you'll know how much legal work and administrative work went into these changes. I think they've done a beautiful job, and therefore I move, as the Commissioner has recommended, that we approve, as a Board of Regents, the revisions to Policy R312 effective immediately and with the approval of the exception for Southern Utah University to use selective admissions.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Aye.
Any opposed? Just as I turn the time over to Regent Scott, Chair of the Finance and Facilities Committee, I just want to remind each of us that this has been now several meetings where we've had this brought forward in the committee of the whole. But the objective of that was to make sure that as regions we were able to be informed as to what was going on essentially in both committees. And so, for example, Finance and Facilities didn't need to review the agenda and decided, how to bring these forward. But I do want to encourage you, in the past we've had the opportunity to discuss some of these in detail in working committees, which would have been done just before that. The intent now with having us all be here together is, as Chair Scott or Chair this way for Chair Jensen, is to make sure that there's the ability to discuss this, ask any questions. I know sometimes we felt before if we got to the committee of the whole, we had the opportunity to discuss it. Now, this is that opportunity. So I encourage you, there are no bad questions, no bad comments, so please be as open and engaged on this. Don't feel like this at this point is a rubber stamping of these things. So with that, I'll turn the time into the chair's staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a lengthy, if you've reviewed your documents, we're going to be here for a few minutes. So sit back and relax and ask your questions. The Finance and Facilities Committee is advancing 12 items. action items found in tabs E through P for the board's review and approval. For each of these items, we'll turn over some time to the respective institution to address, provide a quick summary and address any questions the board may have. So we'll start under tab E, and Jason Perry is presenting.
Jason. Thank you. It's good to be with you all. On behalf of the university, I'm here to request your permission to dispose of a piece of property. Many of you have been to the Thomas S. Monson Center on South Temple. Amazing building. We want to keep that one. But we want to have approval to sell the parking lot that is across the street. Some of you who have parked there have seen that parking lot. It's exactly across D Street. It's a 24-stall parking lot with a sinkhole. That's what we're talking to you about now. And it's about 2.26 acres. We have had an appraisal already done on the property, and the first one is about $850,000 is what the appraisal is for, and that has been turned over to the Hatch Foundation, because they're the ones that would like to purchase this piece of property to build the Orange G. Hatch Center for Legislative Leadership and Public Policy. I know many of you had a chance to talk to Senator Hatch about this this center and his library. The university is looking forward to the opportunity to work with this center. It will be theirs. It's not our center. We're just selling the property to them. But the Gardner Policy Institute, which you know is in the Thomas S. Monson building, and the Hinckley Institute of Politics will be working very closely with the Orange G. Hatch Center once they build the building and do some programming inside of that that property. So that is essentially the proposal. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
I do have just a question. You know, this is currently a parking lot for people who may be coming to the current Monson Center. And I just wonder whether, with now that being constructed as a building, how is that going to impact accessibility to the University of Utah facility? Because I have been there on occasion with parking. Is there a premium, and whether there's some planning about how we can make sure that we're accommodating those who come to conduct business at either center?
Yeah, I got it. Parking is always an issue everywhere, of course. The designs are currently being done for the building itself. Kem Gardner is likely going to be building it. The current design has a replacement of about 17 stalls of those 24. But the more important point is Scott Anderson, if you've seen the map that came with the agenda item, there's a parking lot that is owned by Zions Bank, and they have agreed to put up a sign for that parking lot to be overflow parking for when we have events at the center, which will more than accommodate our needs. And Natalie Gochner has looked at the space needs for when they have events as well. And so we think that overflow parking lot will do the best it can to satisfy the parking demands.
Okay, thank you very much.
Other questions? Hearing none, then I would move to authorize the University of Utah to sell the property located at 427 East South Temple, Salt Lake City.
So we have a motion. Do I have a second?
Second
from Regent Gibson. Thank you. Any discussion?
Thanks.
Questions? Being none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you, Chase. Next, the University of Utah lease renewal. And Jonathan Bates is here. Thank you, Jonathan.
There we go. Sorry about that. On behalf of the University of Utah, I'm here to request approval for an amendment to a lease for some lease space we have in Research Park on behalf of our School of Medicine, Department of Family and Preventative Medicine. You have a summary of the facts of the deal in front of you, so I'll just highlight a couple important points. One is that this has been the home of the department for the last 13 years. The amendment will extend the lease for 5 years while giving us some flexibility in our planning efforts for the transformation project to take advantage of potential available space to relocate them within that 5 years into a university-owned asset if it becomes available. With that said, I'll turn the time over to any questions.
I hate to be the only one asking questions, but it's not specifically with regard to this proposal, but I assume that any time a proposal is coming forward, that if there is a potential related party nature, you know, it's a property owned by a significant donor or something like that, that's highlighted for the regents. Is that just a matter of practice that we do that? So if it,
if the lessor is not identified or the other party, you know, we just can assume that there's no potential conflict of interest.
That's correct. We work with the institutions to collect additional background information as necessary.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Other questions? Hearing none, then I would move to authorize the University of Utah to extend the lease for an additional five-year period, as proposed.
Thank you very much, Chair Stoddard. We have a motion. Do we have a second? Second from Regent Jensen. Any discussion or further questions? Being none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. Utah State University, Dave Calley will address Series 2018 Research Revenue Bonds.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. After having received all of the required approvals for this project, including legislative bonding authority in the last session, Utah State University is now seeking your approval to move forward with issuing revenue bonds for the Space Dynamics Lab Phase 2. In your packets, you have included a preliminary summary sheet showing the parameters of the bond and also an approving resolution. We've worked with Blake Wade as Bond and Disclosure Counsel and Science Public Finance, Brian Baker, as our financial advisors, and we are ready to proceed with a competitive sale in the next few weeks.
Questions? Hearing none, then, I'll move to approve the proposed authorizing resolution to issue research revenue bonds for Utah State University as proposed.
Thank you, Chair Stoddard. Do I have a second? Second from Regent Gibson. Any discussion or questions? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. We invite Paul Morris up, Vice President of Administrative Services for Dixie State University, to talk about property acquisition.
Thank you, Regent Stoddard. We're here seeking your approval to buy 1.29 acres of property. That property is located just south of our campus across the street. It's directly across the street. The thing that's important for you to know about this particular piece is we own three parcels that are adjacent to it. And so if you look at your agenda materials, you'll see a map as one of those items, and you'll see property outlined in yellow. And you'll notice at the top of the page, that piece of property that we're intending to buy, outlined in yellow, there are two parcels next to it that we currently own. And also at the bottom of the page, on the left-hand side, you'll see some white buildings. That's student housing that we also own. So with the property we own and the acquisition of this piece, we'll have about 3 acres down there contiguous. So it's a good acquisition for us. We've had the property appraised. The appraisal came back at $900,000. The owner of the property also had it appraised. That appraisal came back at $1.29 million. And so there was a disparity there. Both of those appraisals used the sales comparison to come up with value, and in many cases used the same property sales to do that, except for the owner's sales comparisons added 2 or 3 additional that ours did not. So in talking to them, we came to a compromise position at $1,130,000, which they will accept at this point. So a while back, I called the Regent's office as we were trying to decide, you know, how quickly we could move on this, because we had a willing seller and we've tried to get this for many years. And they gave us the go-ahead to go ahead and contract for the property contingent upon our trustee approval, which we now have, and your approval. So what we're asking you for you today is to approve that. If you approve it here today, we would close on the property June 1st.
Are there any questions?
Have you defined a future use for the property already?
Well, long term, it will be a land bank for us to be used for academics or E&G type space. In the near term, we've pretty much eliminated our facilities management yard, and we built parking there for our students. So that yard is now a couple hundred parking stalls, and we don't have enough room for our lawnmowers and equipment and all the things that our facilities management need. So they would be down there in the short run, but in the longer run, that won't be its use.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I was just going to say that that's pretty expensive ground for storing lawnmowers.
Well, and
I'm glad you have a longer term.
And the reason the appraisals came in as they did is it is zoned R4, multifamily residential.
Yeah.
Student housing could be built on that property, so it was appraised based on that assumption.
It was interesting, though, to have such a disparity between two certified appraisers, and so I'm sure that must have been an interesting discussion to be willing to accept the additional properties they rolled into their appraisal. Either our appraiser missed some market comps or anyway, that's just not usual to have something that's that big of a gap. So
both of those appraisers were MAI certified.
Well, so. I know. That's always a question, isn't it? Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Regent Wright, did you have a question or comment? Yeah.
And having been a trustee, I know that the expansion has been going to the south. It's landlocked there, the 915, right, on the southern border. And without this piece, you really can't use pieces that you do own because they're contiguous, they're adjacent, or they have easements. So long term gathering now,
available. It's a good strategic acquisition, isn't it? You need it to fill in. So. Yeah, it's like my grandpa used to tell me, you don't get to make any new land. Of course, I don't think he was thinking about Hawaii, so it's, but anyway, all right.
If there are any other questions, then I move to authorize Dixie State University acquire property located approximately 955 East, 500 South in St. George, Utah, as proposed.
All right, have a motion, have a second from Regent Wright. Any further questions? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. Utah Valley University Institutional Residence Repurposing. And Vice President Val Peterson will address that.
Thank you. So as you know, on all campuses, space is a premium. And on our campus, it's definitely a premium. And so as our campus has matured and as our student body has matured, and we have a lot more graduates who are four-year degree and graduate students who've finished, we find the need for an alumni house. So we're requesting that we take the institutional residence that we have right now on campus and make it an alumni house and offer the new president a housing stipend instead. And that way our alumni house can be on campus, and that also, as the campus continues to develop and we continue to have space and land issues, that we can utilize that property for campus purposes.
Questions?
How much acreage
is included? The site's probably 0.75 acres.
Other questions?
Yeah, I think that'll be a good use. That's good.
Okay. Hearing none, then I move to authorize. Commissioner. Oh, Commissioner.
It's all right. It's probably not worth it, but just one thing that I learned through this process, and certainly Vice President Peterson or President Holland could confirm this. Unlike many of the institutional residents, which have ample entertainment space, this one, when it was built a few presidents ago, was purposely designed to not have entertainment space. And so it's less useful as a residence for the typical purposes of entertaining than other residents on campuses are. So this seemed like an appropriate change of use.
Thank you, Commissioner. Then I move to authorize Utah Valley University to repurpose the institutional residence into alumni house and provide a housing allowance for future presidents.
Thank you. Do you have a motion? Do I have a second? Regent Ortega, thank you very much. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Looks like we have another one. Go ahead.
All right, the next item is to enter into an alternative funding agreement with the RSL Academy Incorporated. They've approached us about the possibility of creating an indoor soccer practice facility on Old Mill Road and 400 North, which would be on our new property that's in Vineyard. This practice facility, they would construct at their cost, and they would take care of the operation and maintenance, and we would lease it to them for 40 years for a dollar a year. In return, what we would receive is we would receive the ability to use the facility from 6 in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so our men's and women's soccer programs could practice there throughout the year. And the other thing that we would do is we would do shared use with some fields that we would build around that particular facility. As part of our agreement, we would have a use agreement. There is also a gift that's attached to this. RSL Academy Incorporated would donate $2.6 million to the UVU Foundation, which in turn would be used to build soccer facilities and soccer-related items. And so with that, we could build the fields that would be around this particular facility, and our men's and women's soccer team would get a place to practice all the time.
Questions?
Sure. So the agreement would be 6 acres of property, and it's on the corner of 4th North and Mill Road in Vineyard. It would be a 40-year deal, and we would lease it to them for a dollar a year, but in return we receive a gift back to our foundation of the appraised value of the property. And they would take care of all operation and maintenance of the facility, except for snow removal, which we would take care of. And we would receive usage time in the facility from 6 in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So we would get about 10 hours a day in the facility for practice time or other things that we might possibly need the facility for.
But with the amount that you receive from as a donation, the university will be doing certain things with that money.
Absolutely. It's a restricted gift, and so we would be required to build some additional soccer fields that would be around the facility, which we are planning to do anyway. They're asking for 20 hours of peak time, 20 hours of non-peak time, so those just become shared use fields. And then also we could utilize that money for anything that's soccer related as far as our soccer programs at the institution.
Only final comment I have is I think you bought this ground for, was it about $2 a square foot?
Yeah, $2.50 a square foot.
Can we put you to work buying some other ground for some of us individually?
Happy to do it. I'm right now trying to buy some more right now, so if you want to approve that right now, I'd take that too.
But $2.50 a square foot?
It's $5 a square foot.
Well, that's good when you get appraisal for 10 and you're buying it from there. That's good. Okay.
Are there any other questions? Okay, hearing none, then I move to authorize Utah Valley University to enter into a contract with Real Salt Lake Youth Academy Foundation to lease property on the Vineyard campus and allow the foundation to construct an indoor soccer facility contingent on review of the contract by Attorney General's office.
Good. We have a motion from Regent Stoddard, second from Regent Wright. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thanks, Phil. Salt Lake Community College, Dennis. Series 2018 student building fee revenue bonds.
This is a bit of a bittersweet moment for me because I spent 10 years of my 12-year tenure doing away with all our bonded indebtedness. Now I'm going to ask to add some. That's actually the sweet part, though. Our students feel that we need a student center at our Jordan campus. It's a campus that's almost as big as this as far as students go, and we've gotten approval through the legislature to bond for $13 million, and we're requesting Regent's approval for that bond. We're planning on a 10-year term for that bond. Interest rates are estimated to be between 2.5% and 3%, and we're going to go out with that 10-year plan with a 7-year call provision. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
I do have, maybe you could, since the approval from the legislature was for $13 million, This is a request for approval for us of $15 million because you were allowed to add some incidental costs to the $13 million. But could you lay out for us what is included in that additional $2 million? In terms of capitalizing, whatever.
We don't anticipate it to be $2 million. In order to make sure we wouldn't have to come back for nickel and diming our bond attorney, Blake Wade, and our financial advisor, Kelly Murdoch, put the $15 million in, we think it will be, and I'll refer to Kelly, more like a few hundred thousand.
Right. Actually, current market and the way we believe the market will respond to these bonds, we think the par amount could actually be slightly below $12 million. But as Dennis pointed out, in the market, there is a need for the college to bring to the table a so-called reserve fund that could cost around $1.5 million. And so another cost of issuance we just felt like if being prudent, the college would never issue more than they need. The target amount is $13 million that they will, that is our target for the construction fund.
Okay, so just to make sure I understand then, we will be issuing, we think, around the $13 million, maybe less. So this really is just $2 million of cushion. As I looked at that, I couldn't understand what might be in there. So it's just a reserve that you're...
That's correct, and we have cash reserves from the students' money. In those 2 years that the students did not have any debt service, we continued, and they approved continuing to collect their student building fee funds, and we put that into a reserve fund. So we are sitting there with the cash for the reserves in place.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Okay. I move to approve the proposed authorizing resolution to issue student building fee revenue bonds for Salt Lake Community College as proposed.
Great. Thank you. We have a motion. We have a second from Regent Jones. Any further discussion? Being none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
It'll be nice to have that facility in that that area, won't it? So.
Invite Jake Dettinger from Snow College up, and he'll talk about tuition schedule implementation.
Thank you. On behalf of Snow College, we're here to request an exemption to policy R510 for the implementation of our new tuition schedule, which normally would go into effect for the summer semester. We're asking that be delayed until the fall semester. The reason for that is recently it was brought to our attention by the commissioner's office that our tuition schedule is out of compliance with policy R510 in the fact that each increment needs to be linear, specifically between our one credit rate and our two credit rate. They were not linear. As a result, we adjusted our schedule, and in doing so, that increased our tuition for one credit by 114% and the two credits by 110%. So that's a huge increase, and we have recently received complaints from students as a result, as you can imagine, because at the time we had advertised a 0-3% increase in our truth and tuition hearing. This delay in implementation would forego about $20,000 in tuition, so it's not a huge amount. 36 students are registered for one and either one or two credits, and with about 400 students registered in total. So that is our request. And if you have any questions.
Are there any questions? Hearing none, then I move to approve the one-time exception to policy R510-3.4 tuition of fees, thereby allowing Snow College to implement their 2018 and 19 tuition schedule fall semester instead of summer semester.
Thank you, Chair Stoddard. You have a motion. Do I have a second? Regent Lund, thank you. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thanks, Chair.
It seems it's not a big dollar item, but it does seem like a fairness issue, doesn't it? So
yeah.
Thank you.
Under tab M,
UCHI enrollment forecast. Invite Dr. Henry Schulschit, Commissioner, to address that.
Annually, we prepare enrollment forecasts for you to review and approve. Each of the institutions is actually responsible for preparing their own enrollment forecast. They use different models, whether it's regression, whether it's just statistical analysis, that they look at various factors: student enrollment, population growth, the economy, and those types of efforts. Those projections are then vetted by the IR group and for validity of assumptions that they bring forward, and now you have what's in front of you. So back in 2015, the board adopted a strategic plan that indicated that we would grow about 50,000 students between 2015 and 2025. To this point, we've grown 12,000 students against that original plan. The enrollment projections for the next 10 years, so from now until 2027, indicate that we will grow an additional 49,000 students, making a total of 57,000 students that we would anticipate growing. This enrollment growth is slowed slightly from last year's projections, and part of that, again, is due to the model. It's due to some of the demographic shifts of our student population, and we're seeing the realization of that, but we are still growing dramatically. These enrollment projections will be used for the capital development prioritization process in terms of determining need for buildings, and it also influences information about the budget development process as we look forward. With that, I'm happy to address any questions that you might have about the enrollment projections, but this is an annual activity that we do, and we seek your approval so we can begin our budgeting and capital development process.
Questions?
So, Kimberly, this is just a projection of in-state enrollment growth, is that right? Or does this include out-of-state growth as well?
It includes all students coming coming into the system.
Okay. All right. This is, you know, obviously we're going to be wrong in our projections. I think we already had some discussion this morning about the impact of unemployment rates and job opportunities for a lot of our students who may be deciding to work for a period of time.
The economy
may slow down. That'll have an impact as well. But this is good. But I think the other thing is that this assumes that we do no better than we're doing today in terms of reaching out to underserved communities. So if we're actually doing a better job with first generation or minority students, suddenly we're going to see growth in this as well, then, correct?
That would be correct. And to give accolades to the institutions, they have done a much better job over time in projecting their enrollment increases. From a system perspective, we're pretty dead on with respect to headcount, and FTE will change based on how many credit hours a student chooses to take, and that's influenced by the economy and work situations. So the institutions have done a lot of work in refining their models for enrollment, and so we feel confident that at least we know we're headed in the right direction. With respect to if we can maintain the same things we're currently doing, but there's always room for improvement and expanding that, and we have a huge opportunity ahead of us to serve additional students that we aren't traditionally reaching.
It's not just outreach, it's also to get better with retention.
And retention, yeah. That's right. That's probably even the more significant factor, so thank you very much, President.
Questions? Hearing none, this will be a lengthy motion, so hang in there with me.
This one's not.
This will be a short motion. The next one will be a lengthy motion. I move to approve the 10-year enrollment projection for Utah State Higher higher Education System. That was the quick one.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Stoddard. We have a motion. Do we have a second? Second from Regent Jensen. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
The next will be a lengthy one, but we'll. Dr. Henry, you are.
Yes. I can do this one. So the next item is for performance-based funding. So during the legislative session, we received $3.8 million of new resources to fund performance-based funding. Last year, Senate Bill 117 codified our metrics a little bit more. Senator Milner put into perspective that we need to have market demand account for 25% of our formula distribution, that we would look at underserved students with respect to completion rather than at entrance. And so this is taking those changes and applying the $3.8 million into that formula. The institutions, half of them received 100% of what they could earn. The other half, we have two institutions, Dixie and Utah Valley, who will receive 50% of their allocation. We have Snow College, which will receive 87.5% of their allocation, and Salt Lake Community College, which will receive 75% of their allocation. And part of that has to do with performance and specific metrics associated with the performance-based funding formula. Half of the formula is dedicated to the yield rate of degrees per 100 FTE, and if you do not hit that metric, you do not qualify, you lose 50% of the dollars, and that's what happened with both Dixie and UVU. Part of the challenge that we continue to face with performance-based funding is whether 1% performance is the right value or not. Now, when we've talked to the governor's office, they have significant concerns saying that 1% may be too easy of a metric. In what we're seeing is, as the model has evolved, we've made some changes, or the statute made some changes last year that takes current year performance against a five-year rolling average. That creates a significant amount of volatility, so it could be that they are up 1% next year and they could be way down the year after. So there's not a lot of consistency versus how we had originally designed it, being a five-year to five-year rolling average. So as we're working with GLMB and we're working with the legislature, one of the things that we're trying to make sure that we understand is whether 1% is a real number to use. It may be great for some metrics, but it may not be great for others. And so we may need to look at each metric by metric to determine whether that's the right value. But for now, statute is what it is, and it's 1%, you earn 100%. If you have any decline or no performance, you earn no money. That's how statute is outlined. If you have any performance improval between 0 and 1%, the dollar amount that you earn is prorated based on that factor. So the idea is that the board would approve this allocation. We have reallocated the dollars that weren't earned back through the formula. They will go to the institutions based on what they did earn. That will be a base adjustment that will go into the base budgets for the institutions effective the 2020. So the next legislative session, we'll work with Spencer Pratt to make sure that that happens. It'll be a one-time transfer from our office, but the institutions will use this as a base increase. In July, we will report back to you how the institutions actually plan to use these dollars. It is something that we normally do. We tell them, here's your allocation, and now they can actually put it as part of their budget process to tell us how they'll use those dollars, and we'll bring it back to you and report in July. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you have about the performance-based funding formula or the allocation.
Bob.
So I think the idea of performance funding just sounds like a great idea, and to be able to move the strategic direction of where higher education should be going, in theory, this sounds like a really good idea. And in practice, it just seems like this is like not working out that well. And with an uncertain base of funding from year to year, makes it really hard to plan in the future. And for criticism to be there's such a discrepancy here that the criticism is that these are too easy, and then we have institutions that are getting 50%. I mean, there's no way to have an ongoing program to deal with retention or completion or the priorities of the Board of Regents in the system of higher education. And it just seems like this needs to be reworked. I mean, there's got to be some consensus with the people that work in the Capitol about, you know, what this is going to do, but to just have one-time funding, you can't set up ongoing programs. You can't solve these problems. This is not a one-year solution to these problems, and this is just an example of a program that's not working well.
I agree 100% with Bob. This is, it's not just with the legislators, it's also with, Kristen Cox and the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, who feel that these are softball numbers, and yet, as she said, she doesn't claim to be an expert on higher education, and I think that
you know, I would be very interested in hearing from some of our presidents today to inform us as regents, so that as we interact with legislators and with the governor's office, that we have a better sense of how you feel about performance funding and how this model is working or not working. So, go ahead.
There we go. I'll just comment on this year's. I mean, we're certainly grateful for performance funding, and we're very willing to look at completion and access and the metrics that they're trying to move. I'll tell you from our experience this year, the market demand category was proved very frustrating. And that is because the way they're doing it with the high demand jobs and the SIP codes, unless the institution is right on, I guess, working collectively with the commissioners and the legislatures, there's some assumptions made based on the SIP codes. And for our institutions, you never look so closely at something until you don't get money. And then you look at it very closely and you realize all of our computer science, none of our computer science degrees counted because they were in a different SIP code than they used. It's an economically high demand position. We had associate degrees awarded and certificates, and none of that counted because of the model. It's really just some of the definitional problems. Some of it is the way that we value or don't value associate's degrees, the same way we value bachelor's degrees. So for anyone with a community college mission, out of 128 major codes, 8 of them are associate degrees. The rest are all bachelor's. So if you're awarding associate degrees, you're not getting the same level of merit, I will say. And when it comes to dollars, that becomes problematic. So we are comfortable with performance funding, but to Regent Marquardt's point, this particular market demand piece has lots of complexities that we need to iron out if we want to be, I think, tell our story more accurately.
And part of the challenge, to build on kind of what President Havdalin has been talking about, is the market demand, the fields that we're allowed to give rewards for, that is now being established and determined by DWS and GOED specifically. And when they look at it not only as the five-star jobs, but they're looking at it by educational attainment level. And unfortunately, that has a significant impact on the tech schools as well as the community college as it relates to that, because those jobs aren't necessarily five-star by the definition that's used for DWS and GOED. They are high demand, they may have reasonably high wages, but those types of issues are kind of where the hiccups are coming into play. So a lot of the changes that Senate Bill 117 put into play, we're kind of seeing the unintended consequences of that, as well as the funding mechanism that was originally designed to be put into place. So as Regent Marquardt had talked about, the idea behind performance-based funding was, it sounds great on paper. We'll create an ongoing funding source that will put more money into it because we're going to be graduating more of these students. They're going to create income tax, and then we're going to siphon off a piece of that income tax and put it back into higher education. When they actually started running the formula and looking at what the impact was in terms of the income tax of those 20% of the 20% of the 20% kind of jobs, it's about $1 to $2 million a year. When you look at that and divide it across 8 institutions, you're not going to make a significant difference on any of those particular metrics. So in order to have performance funding work, it's going to take something different than what's currently been established and an investment by the state to actually infuse dollars, whether or not they're generated by this formula or not.
I do think that I don't think we're going to be able to change the fact that there's performance funding, but what we have to do is be able to learn from our experience here and go into to put forward the case that if you have high demand jobs and we're all about, you know, stackable credentials, pathways, mm-hmm. and that having associate's degrees in those same fields is important, those ought to count, mm-hmm. because it's those same people with an associate's degree who will be coming back and right. looking for further degrees and stuff. So anyway, I think it is something that we're going to have to take notice of and go lobby hard on. So yeah.
Okay. I probably don't need to speak because I think a lot of the key points have just been made. I just certainly would echo it and suggest that, you know, the performance-based funding should be akin to like the rule of law. I mean, the point is it should be concrete, it should be prospective, it should be guiding us to be the behaviors we know that we want to, you know, have happen. and we're still not there yet. I mean, we came into this last budget cycle very late, just not knowing how much we would get out of the formula, like a few weeks ago. I mean, that is not a formula that's clearly working to tell us what we need to be doing in order to get the money. And so we really have some very fundamental problems here. And I also think there has to be, again, a continuing education process about what change means in the context of academic cycles. And I know 1% doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're taking action on things that are going to take 2, 3, 4, 5 years before you ever see the full implications of the change, that's where getting these 5-year rolling averages is so key, and we don't have that right, and that's a big part of the problem here. So.
There we go. The only way to produce change in a large, complex organization is to have a very clear compass that you can inspire and motivate people toward. And when it changes and moves around and is not transparent and is unpredictable, it is very, very hard to get your department chairs, your faculty, your deans mobilized around this. And if we don't do that, we can't really make change. So couldn't be more in agreement that the goals are right of performance funding. The formula needs work. And you know, this is from the perspective of an institution that has benefited from it, mm-hmm. but it's really hard to translate that into action that you can talk to your faculty about. And until we can do that, we're really missing opportunities to drive change.
Well, and you can't make investments in long-term changes if you don't right. know if the money's going to be there
That's
from
right.
year to year.
You so. Have to be prepared to walk back from it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other questions? Other questions? Pat.
So I'm wondering where we go from here. I mean, what are our options?
Well, that is a very good question. I visited with Senator Miller just this week to ask her if, because at one point last year she was thinking of doing a bill to tweak this. I think at this point she's not inclined to, but I'm sure that she would be open to some feedback from us as well. I think that one of the challenges is there were some things that we had carefully worked out in our model, and it was still fairly new, but for example, the market demand was addressed. That was changed in the bill to have DWS set what that market demand was, and we're not obviously in agreement, and but now it's out of our hands. The 5-year rolling average to 5-year rolling average, we did that to try to level things out and to not have ups and downs. That was changed in the legislation. So I'm sure we're going to continue to have dialogue with her. We are somewhat caught in between because, as was indicated, there's another point of view at the Capitol, which is that this should be requiring much greater progress every year than 1%. And I think you'd have to say, in implementing the model that we have, that was approved by the legislature, if everyone were getting 100% every year, then I would agree, well, maybe that isn't enough of a push. But when you're getting several that are getting much less than that, I think it's much harder to really make the case that this 1% is too low or too easy to obtain, so.
I think this warrants more inclusive discussion from our presidents, and then maybe we come up with some recommendations that are very specific to go back to the sponsor. So,
would you like to proceed with the motion?
Sure.
Okay. Or do we want to rework it?
I think we have to approve.
Okay.
But I do think the reason for my question is just to make sure that the presidents need to be able. I want to make sure the regents are informed on how the presidents really feel about this.
Whether, yeah.
And you know, even in goal setting, there's one thing to set a benchmark that we have to meet this. And if you don't meet it, you don't get funding. That's one thing. But sometimes we set goals which are stretch goals, and you know, and we don't anticipate that people will meet all those. Well, here we're setting goals. It should be we really, in our long term, this is somewhere where we need to accomplish, and that money should be. I wouldn't be disappointed if people did meet that goal, because it's kind of like we're on the path, and here's where you need to be in order to be successful is your institution, perhaps. But anyway, I just think we need the presidential input, organize that, and go back and seek some revision to that.
So. Well, and I'd like to add that I have some issues even with the workforce needs and defining those.
Yes.
Because DWS will have a very different view of what that looks like compared to the information that we all hear from our employers. So I think that whole ball of wax needs to look.
When you think about those, we're investing, you know, 6 years out on someone in a degree mm-hmm. invest, perhaps. And so, you know, we can't be having, you know, these kinds of movement or not including certain key degrees. So.
We really appreciate the discussion from the presidents and the regents. It's been very helpful, and hopefully that'll help us direct a better approach going forward. In light of that, I'd move to approve the performance funding allocation recommendations for each institution as outlined on the cover memo and direct the institution to use the performance-based funding to enhance the overall performance of the institution, including the areas of total number of graduates in high market demand areas, service to underserved populations, improving retention and graduation rates, and report back to the board in July of 2018 board meeting highlighting planned uses of the funds.
Okay, thank you, Regent Stoddard, Chair Stoddard. Do we have a motion? Do I have a second?
Do I have a second? Second from Regent Marquardt. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. Motion carries.
Thank you. Under tab O, revision of policy R513, tuition waivers and reductions. Commissioner Buehler and Dr. Henry.
Thank you, Chair Stoddard. And let me just go from one easy topic to another here. So you might remember as a board that in the last July, you had the annual report on tuition waivers. And that led to some further discussion, which we had in a discussion session in September of 2017. That was then carried forward into the affordability working group, which took a look at this issue. Now, meanwhile, the legislature has also had quite an interest in the topic of the use of tuition waivers, and including in the Higher Education Appropriations Committee. This past legislative session, there was language included in House Bill 300 that directed the board to do three things. Well, I'll start with these three things. To define meritorious and need-based aid, to establish caps on a discretionary waiver for out-of-state students. There is a cap already on the non-resident. There's many different waivers, but I'm talking about the two largest categories. There is a cap already on the resident, but there was not on non-resident, and to regularly assess the use of waivers. Well, today's recommendation to you is to begin implementing those policies that you had looked at previously or were interested in and that comply with House Bill 300. It designates, and this came from the Affordability Working Group, that 10% of the discretionary resident waivers be used for need-based aid. So that was a direct response from the Affordability Working Group. Secondly, it will set caps for the first time on non-resident discretionary waivers. It caps, now this is a cap not on the number of students who receive it, but on the percentage of tuition that may be waived. Now there's a wide variety among our institutions of their need for these waivers, their use of these waivers. It's impacted by the location of the institution, by their student mix, by their long-term enrollment strategies. There's also a bit of a long tail on this because of the way that these waivers are awarded to students as scholarships. They don't know often that it's a waiver. They are told they've received a scholarship. And so it's a very complicated issue, but we do have as a starting place caps that we ask the institutions to recommend where that should be placed for this year. And then it also requests in the action item today, your authorization for a study, and this was also included in HB 300. Likely we would bring in an outside consultant for a comprehensive review of tuition and student aid policies related to resident and non-resident students. And I think that one issue that we probably ought to look at, this is going a little bit beyond but I just want to raise it in case there's any reaction or just to put it on the table, is that given our capacity challenges we have as a fast-growing state and the challenges we're going to have accommodating resident students, that we probably ought to at least start thinking about the question of what is the proper mix of resident to non-resident student at our institutions. Now, the other part of this motion is that the caps will be reviewed over 3 years and also may be reconsidered as a result of the study that we're asking you to authorize us to go forward with an outside consultant. So happy to respond to questions. There may be other questions that you may want to address to presidents if you have any, but that is our recommendation. I feel good about moving this very difficult but very important issue forward to the Board of Regents today. So I'll turn it back to you, Chair Stoddard.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I have one question. How were the caps initially set? When did that happen and how were they, just in a nutshell?
The ones that are recommended today, you would be setting them today. This would be the first time that there have been caps on the non-resident discretionary waiver. And what we did is we sought input from the institutions because they already have enrollment management plans in place. They already have sometimes commitments that were made. And so we looked at several different ways to do it, including that my office would set a number or something. But ultimately, with discussion with the presidents, felt that probably the most responsible thing to do at this point was to have them give us the number that they felt would that they could live with, that they could work with, and at least that's a starting point, and then we can evaluate it so that we don't do any unintended harm.
Regent Marquardt.
You know, I just maybe point out that I think this is fine, but it's, you know, kind of one piece of the puzzle, and what the agenda has is just the cap on merit non-resident waivers, not total non-resident waivers. So while Weber stands out as having the highest cap, the number of non-resident students at Weber is one of the lowest in the state, and well, the third or fourth lowest. I mean, there's four or five with about 20% non-resident students, and Weber only has 10. And it's a complicated issue because, you know, I guess automatically you think, well, the money should go to the Utah students, but this is a big driver of revenue for to bring new programs and other benefits. So if they can cover the cost, instructional cost, by discounting the out-of-state tuition somewhat, that's a big factor. So I mean, it's a complicated issue, but I totally support the idea of a study to bring together all the different elements of this and have more of a strategic direction of where we're going and how we're going to allocate money, whether it's waivers or differential tuition or, you know, the community college, this issue we talked about earlier today, it's a first step.
Yeah, I think, Bob, that this is, you're right, we're really just dealing with a sliver. And yet we recognize as regents and presidents that this, the whole issue of student waivers or tuition waivers has grown dramatically, and I think it's an issue that presidents are using for revenue management, and we appreciate the fact that you can increase revenue by bringing in out-of-state students, but I do think that it's important this is not immersive. This is like sticking our toe in the water, as you say. It's a very small issue with caps. I don't even know if the caps are the right caps. You say it's even complicated. You look at Weber and say 40%. It seems awfully high. If they're 20% today, that's a lot of headroom, but yet, you know, they may be very low in terms of the absolute impact from that policy. So I do think this is something that we need to keep on the radar. We're going to have to continue to refine, get a little deeper into, make sure that, you know, we're not having adverse consequences with our presidents. But let's be honest. I mean, the governor's office, the legislature, having raised this and discuss it in a forum like this, suddenly everybody's talking about it. And now I think we just have to follow through. We don't want to take any arbitrary, you know, knee-jerk reactions. But, you know, let's go ahead and at least start walking down that path of, you know, just as one regent, I would like to make sure that we're not investing so heavily in bringing out-of-state students in. I am supportive at some level, but I do think we have to be able
to assist our first-generation and underserved communities, non-traditional students, and that if we're absorbing everything with out-of-state effectively, then that makes it hard for us to manage the system. And so it's just going to take a lot more discussion, as you say, to make sure we really understand that.
Other questions? Concerns? We very much appreciate the discussion. I move to adopt the revised policy R513, tuition waivers, reductions, and approve additional recommendations as outlined in the cover memo, and encourage the Commissioner's Office to begin to work to engage in a study that will help identify the economic and broader impact of non-resident students for UCHI institutions as well as the state as a whole.
Thank you, Chair Stoddard. Do we have a motion? Do we have a second? Second from Regent Marquardt. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? I do want to just make sure that point out the incredible effort that this has taken, even though it's a small sliver and we're not moving that aggressively right now, but it's taken a lot of work to try and understand this. So Dr. Henry and all those who work with her and people at our individual institutions, we appreciate that this is a real issue at some institutions, some more than others, but express appreciation to all those who've kind of, you know, sweat over these kinds of issues. It's appreciated.
Thank you. Under tab P, capital development prioritization and adoption of priority guidelines, Dr. Henry and Rich.
Absolutely. So, Rich, if you'd like to come up, I'll turn this to you.
Thank you. So every year we, at this time of the year, we start the capital development process that we just concluded with the legislative session, but we're starting again here to adopt guidelines for the coming year. And you have in your packet in tab P, the proposal for this year's guidelines have been adopted by the capital committee that met in April to discuss the prior process and discuss what they would like to see for this year coming forward. And so it's largely the same process with two parts. So there's a quantitative part that our office, that myself and Dr. Henry work on to provide the quantitative assessment for needs and facility condition. And then the second part is the qualitative piece, of which this is the guideline for. So in that tab P, it shows how the qualitative points would be awarded by the capital committee. And again, this year, like last year, there was a new process where they requested input from this full board with institutions providing a presentation on the Thursday meeting, and you looking at certain categories to award points that we call criteria points. This year we're proposing, instead of last year there's 10 that we found was a lot to comprehend and put together for criteria, we've reduced that to five areas, and we actually have a modification from what was sent out in the packet based on comments from the Capitol Committee, where we would like to change the name on the very last criteria. That right now it reads access. We, after discussion, it really should read capacity. And what we would want to do is to reallocate the number of points, the possible points from, right now there's one that has three and one that has one. We'd make it so that they're all twos. And the idea behind this is because if you look at the current strategic objective that reads capacity, there's really two parts to capacity. You can either build the capacity by using your facilities more efficiently through utilization, or you could build the capacity through new facilities. Mm-hmm. And so we're recognizing that there are two parts to capacity, and they ought to be prioritized the same with 2 points. And so that's our recommendation for this guideline to come forward, and this would be in the September meeting where the regents would prioritize the capital needs going forward.
Thank you, Rich. Questions?
they're two capacities, yeah. It'd be capacity.
Well, it addresses the idea of having the two capacities. Is it would actually address the same initiative. It's just the strategic objective that it would be linked or tied to. So you've got affordable participation, you've got timely completion, and you've got workforce. We've got five criteria. The capacity one would be tied to two of the criteria.
No.
No, so it balances it out. So the bottom, the second criteria associated where it was called access is taking into account the growth element that the first criteria related to capacity does not necessarily take head on. So the idea of elimination of space, elimination of functionally obsolete kind of equipment, those types of things that help you improve capacity, that's one way to address capacity constraints or needs. The second one is if you just flat out are out of space and you're growing and you need a brand new building. So this addresses the ability to get points. You may not get points in both categories. If you take space down and you build a new building, you could possibly get points in both categories. But again, it's specifically looking at existing space and new space and how you're effectively managing
those. But Dr. Henry, help me understand here. If you have two institutions that have the same utilization of facilities today and they're both growing, and one has older facilities that are perhaps obsolete, so they're going to be taking out some space, and Institution B doesn't even have the space, then if I understand this, Institution A is going to get more points. Because they're taking out some existing capacity and then adding this new building. Institution B, who has the same strain, doesn't even have the space today, perhaps, is penalized in terms of getting on this ranking because they don't have any space to take out of the inventory.
It wouldn't necessarily, but they get additional points. It just, the way that their project, this is going to be project-oriented specifically. So
well, I'm just saying, if everything else is equal, doesn't that first capacity give the institution removing space, tearing down an old building, where they're going to get some more points than an institution that's going, hey, I don't even have anything to tear down?
And that's the balance where I think the board actually needs to kind of address in terms of priorities. So you've talked about the need to make sure that the existing space is taken care of and renovated and that we're doing the right things that we're doing. It's historically been a priority of this board to try and award institutions that are taking care of the space or looking at ways to enhance that capacity. If you feel that it's not a priority, it is something that can be removed, but up to this point, it's been a balance between wanting to make sure that there's a venue for existing space for some of our older campuses versus some of the younger campuses where they're adding additional spaces. So we're at the direction of the board. We're happy to remove the criteria around the utilization. But then you're missing some scoring points for an institution, say like Meadowbrook, where it's no longer a viable space. But if they were to take it down and remodel it or do something else with that, they would benefit. Yeah.
So is there an incentive for an institution to put up a bunch of tough sheds that they could then take down?
Well, the expectation isn't necessarily that you earn 100% of the points in this cap, in these.
No, yes, that's why I was trying to think of a situation that may be identical in terms of the strains of growth, and yet we have now put one institution over another based upon just they've been there for longer and had more space.
And it's 10 points a
And the other thing I bring up is that, so these are worth 10 points. So we've divided the 25 qualitative points into 10 and 15. There's still 15 that could address these kind of issues that you're bringing up, because we recognize that there's always things that we can't capture with a formula or with criteria, and those ought to be discussed. I think there ought to be a robust discussion around that, and 15 points would be enough to shift anything.
But as Bob says, we continually come down to a situation where 1 point is the difference between rankings, and that's tough for regions.
It's true.
Other questions, concerns?
I think we have to approve this for this year, but I don't want us to feel like this is an ideal model. I mean, I do agree with taking down the 3-2, and we need to just make sure that we are being very, exercising good judgment in the application of those other 15 points. But, you know, when it gets that tight, it's hard for any region to argue, you know, moving points to cancel out some other quantitative or in this category. It's just hard to do.
Sure.
So I think we need to have our committee continue to revisit this and see if there's as with anything, it's good. It's where we are, but we need to be continually thinking about how else we can improve it. So.
Okay.
And certainly, this isn't just a region question. It was certainly any presidents or their staff that have ideas, I'm sure we would be more than happy to consider any of those. So.
Sure. Regent Barnes.
Regent Stoddard, would you share with us a little bit about the process? I know many of us have sat at the committee for years, and how we assess these kinds of issues. It's not a great answer to the discussion going on, but it does give us insight to that process on the discretionary point for Regent
Marquardt. Well, Regent Marquardt was chaired, so he can certainly he's well informed and anxious to probably to address that.
So, you know, as we make the tour of all the institutions and look at the projects, we fill out this scoring sheet as to who's going to rank where. So, and, you know, there's ability, discretion to make some movement around to, you know, if you think it's not working out fairly, you can change it. And at the end, we get together in a meeting and see if, you know, what the total ranking is looks fair. But, I mean, this is important and is going to make a big difference. So I just think it needs to be as clear as possible, and I don't really have a better solution, but it does seem like there's a message here that if you really are going to game this, which is only smart to do, that you're going to come up with a peculiar solution that may not be the best. So I don't know whether combining those two capacity together or some other, but it probably deserves a little bit more thought, because I mean, anybody that wants to score well is going to pay a lot of attention to this.
Does this actually need to be approved today, or is this something that we could have some further deliberation in advance of our September process? We have the July meeting.
So I think that would be up to you. So the calendar, though, is so right now, institutions are in the process of developing their capital development projects, and they will propose those that will they do what's called a needs statement, where they kind of do some feasibility for the buildings. That's typically done in July, and so I think you could wait till July, but just know that institutions are already putting their projects together, and it's helpful for them to have some guidance before that happens.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the institutions are putting together their projects right now and planning what they're going to move forward with. So this is, it's too late to do it in July. But it could be a quick look by Rich and Kimberly and whoever else, and then maybe go to the executive committee for a quick change if they can come up with anything better. But the institutions need guidance pretty quickly.
The quickest and easiest solution, it's never bright to kind of do these at the table, but if you were to actually combine the two metrics together to a single capacity metric, increase the points to 4, you can get it either way. And so then the same piece is there. It's just you can earn up to the 4 points, or you can earn partial. And that would just be a matter of adjusting the motion to say combine the two capacity measures and increase that points value to 4, and we stay within our parameters.
It's modified. I think that is an improvement. So,
so that you'd prefer that? Is that?
I'd be interested in hearing other regions, but I think it's better to probably combine that. Sorry.
I think that's a good solution, and if any of the presidents are